Welcome to another episode of Random Trek, where I, your host, Scott McNulty, talk about a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. Today, my guest is Moises Chulyan. Did I say that right?
Moises? You got it. You got it.
Look
you
at
got
that. It.
Whew. Nice. Out of the park.
It's like you're part Klingon.
Kapla.
Perfect.
There you go.
Now tell me a little bit about your interest in Star Trek. Are you a Star Trek fan?
I'm a huge Star Trek fan, going back to when I was a kid. And when I was a kid, The Next Generation was a relatively new thing. It started when I was just before I started elementary school. And so I missed the first few seasons when they originally aired because they were instantly in syndication. I caught up on basically everything because it was always on the weekends, multiple episodes and so on. And I saw the third season Next Generation episode where a particular crewman dies.
Oh, can't say who. No,
can't
spoilers
say who. No spoilers
here.
No spoilers here on this show that randomly selects episodes from one decade or another. Who knows? I was hooked. I was into the original series. I was into Next Generation. I was initially doubtful about Deep Space Nine and missed a handful of episodes or the first couple of seasons, and then settled in with it very comfortably and became a big, big fan of it. I was less of a fan of Gilligan's Island on a spaceship, and I was unfortunate in that when Enterprise came on, I liked what I saw, but because of the status of UPN in Tallahassee, Florida, not really having a solid single channel that carried their shows, I saw the first maybe three episodes, and then you literally couldn't see it in Tallahassee. So I didn't really get into it until DVD, and then I wasn't even really heavily into it until they started releasing these Blu-rays, and I dug into it like crazy, and I'm part of the way through properly watching it all the way through chronologically. But as a Trek fan, I often test the Next Generation Trek fan level of friends by just blank throwing Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra. And if they know what I'm talking about, okay, points, good. You're on to the next level. And then we get into exactly our thoughts on Reginald Barclay.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, how many series Worf can really sustain.
Infinite.
Something we'll probably talk about on this episode, how I feel like eventually Deep Space Nine became the everybody's trapped on the space station together, and it seems like everyone eventually has to want to sleep with each other, no matter how bizarrely mismatched they are.
Well, it's like a college dorm, right?
Yeah. Eventually, if you're stuck in the same dorm all year, I mean, everybody has to sleep with everybody, right? That's the rule of TV.
That's what happens, I think.
Something like that.
So speaking of Deep Space Nine, the episode of which we're going to talk about today is, in fact, from Deep Space Nine. It is called Looking for Parmok in All the Wrong Places from Season 5, Episode 3. And fun fact from Memory Alpha, apparently this is the episode with the second longest title in Star Trek history.
It is pretty long, and there's Klingon right in the title, so you know that you're getting a Klingon episode.
So you know Ronald D. Moore wrote it, because he loves the Klingons.
I imagine at some point Ron Moore will come back to Star Trek so that they will let him do the Kalos and Lucerne epic Seven Samurai war movie that is played totally straight.
It is
with like
destiny.
A $60 million budget.
Well, if they kickstart that, I'll get in on it. So we actually, I skipped over letting people know where they know you from. So that's the magic of editing.
I'm not sure that anybody knows me from anywhere. Actually, you should just leave this in. This is the flow of it. This is sometimes how it goes. Sometimes, you know, you just roll with where things come from.
I
started out podcasting, doing shows on 5x5. Where still, as of this recording, I'm co-hosting The Critical Path as often as Horace is available to record it. Horace Dedue, the owner and founder of asimco.com. And a number of months ago, I took my two main shows, renamed one of them, and relaunched them alongside a third signature show on my own network, ESN for short, Electric Shadow Network, if you're nasty, which you can find at ESN.fm. And the main show, which the network is named after, is Electric Shadow, where it's a panel show that can talk about movies, TV, video games to an extent. Basically, stories told on glowing screens with moving images. But mostly leaning toward the cinema and TV thing, and the way that not only the media we consume is consumed, but the way that it's made and the ways that that's changing and the effect technology has on it. I took the title of it from the direct Chinese translation of the term for cinema, which Electric Shadow just felt like interesting, poetic kind of something or another. So on an upcoming episode of that may actually be up by the time this episode that you're listening to right now posts, I got Bo Willem, the creator of House of Cards, to promise that he would just talk to me for an hour about video games and how he thinks he seriously thinks it's the future of storytelling, and not because it's easy, but because there's so much more direct interaction with the audience. So yeah, that's the main one. I've got a show about comics and comic discovery that I host with John Golson called Giant Size. That is, you know, even if you say, oh, I don't read comics, I don't care about comics, it's actually designed exactly for you, in addition to the people that are super huge comics nuts, like me and Merlin Mann, who has a comic show called Back to Work on 5x5. And then the third main show is Thank You for Calling, a show about the world of customer service. And the common thread between all three is that in some respect, they're all about storytelling. In some respect, I think that the world of customer service is interesting from an anthropological point of view, which is what I studied as an undergrad, where we all think that we know a lot about it because we come from one side of the counter at the retail store or the phone conversation with a call center. We come from one side or another, and we think we know a whole lot about the whole thing. And I think there's a lot to dig into and sift through, and we've had some fun on that one.
Well, check those, after you finish listening to this, check out all those other podcasts.
Yes, many, many, many podcasts.
You have you're a podcast for every night. Something, I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, well, by the time I finally get caught up on like supplementary like interview shows and stuff that I've been meaning to put up, I'll finally be caught up. I actually missed the opportunity to get some interviews with some Next Generation cast people, including like LeVar Burton and Jonathan Frakes and everything at Dallas Comic Con that I'm still kicking myself over. But they come back to that show like once a year, and up in Dallas they do two or three shows a year, so I'll get them eventually.
You'll get them all. I have a strange connection to Jonathan Frakes in that I went to – his father was an English professor at the college I went to. And no I joke. I was assigned – he was my advisor. And I did not know – his name was Professor Frakes, and I'm being a huge Star Trek fan. I obviously recognized the name Frakes, but I didn't think there was any relation until I went to Professor Frakes' office, and there was a giant cutout of Jonathan Frakes in his Riker uniform with a little sign on it that said, "Hi, Pop." And then I thought, they might be related somehow. I don't
know. Your son doesn't happen to be Jonathan Two Takes Frakes.
I didn't ask. I never asked. I played it cool. And Professor Frakes was a little wacky himself, so I don't know if he would have liked me asking too much, but
can I mention a tiny anecdote that just comes to mind because we were talking about Jonathan Frakes, one of my favorite Trek directors, not just of movies but you know episodes and all that good stuff. One of my favorite bits of trivia about this Looking for Parmok and all the Wrong Places episode is that as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, and your research is probably 10 times better than mine. Is this the only Deep Space Nine episode directed by Andrew J. Robinson?
I believe it might be.
A.K.A. Garak. Garak directed this episode and does not appear in it, though he is mentioned.
He is mentioned, as he often is. And he is one of my favorite. Deep Space Nine is one of my, well, I'll say this. I've said this before. The Next Generation holds a spot in my heart because it's when I got introduced to Star Trek. Yeah. So it's kind of my default Star Trek. But if I'm looking at kind of interesting characters and interesting stories, I rate Deep Space Nine as the best example of Star Trek, oh, yeah. Even though it's kind of, you know, they're in one place, they add a ship later, but it's all about the characters.
Just add ship.
Exactly, that's all you need. And I think that especially this episode got me to thinking about how many of the characters on Deep Space Nine would be so out of place on other Star Trek franchises.
Hugely so. Remind me, I want to say something about Chief O'Brien specifically in that respect. But I, you know, this is going to be controversial, and I want people to quote this. I want people to make this episode live in infamy, so that, you know, hopefully this is what literally causes Random Trek to be the breakout success, more downloads than the main Incomparable show, everything. All of my friends look at me like something very, very unpleasantly odorous happened when I say, you know, I think all things considered, Deep Space Nine's my favorite series.
I'm right there with you. You need a better class of friend, is what we just learned.
Now I've got one. The thing about Deep Space Nine is, throughout its life, you know, people can say what they will about, oh, well, they had at a ship, or, well, then it just became a serial for two seasons or whatever. I think those are huge pluses, because we got to play in the same universe with different rules, different chess boards and chess pieces, so to speak. It was like the series equivalent of three-dimensional chess. There's a whole crap load of stuff going on. Damned if I can really be sure exactly how it all makes sense that it happened in the same world, but it sure as hell was entertaining. And not just entertaining for entertaining's sake. There were threads that they picked back up. And actually, this episode picks a thread back up from the third season, where they introduce the female Klingon character at the center of it. And in fact, I'd forgotten that episode completely existed before I looked it up on Memory Alpha. I was like, oh, yeah, now I remember that. You know, Dax recounting to Worf, who wasn't around in season three. So, yeah, here's who she is, and here's what Quark did. And I was like, wait, she's recapping an entire episode.
Yes,
that was five lines of exposition.
Very quickly. You don't need to drag it out. And that's a great episode as well. And I enjoy Quark is one of the characters I was thinking of that would feel like you couldn't have a Quark on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
I mean, unless he was like working in 10 forward or something, I don't know.
Yeah, like he was Guinan's, you know, malcontent employee or something. There's something that I love about how tremendously out of place loads of elements of Deep Space Nine can be made to feel, and that's why, you know, episodes like this where you put Quark in Klingon armor and put a batleth in his hands, and you're like, that's just what. Or, you know, the Mirror Universe episodes, which I mentioned before we started, those are some of my favorites because they get to do really bizarre, like, Marvel Comics what-if stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, what if Kira Nerys was kind of like a lesbian dominatrix, but she was actually bisexual and then got even weirder and more out there as the series went on and we kept going back to this parallel universe? What if?
These are valid questions, I think. And the other, like... Odo is a great character who would not fit in on another Star Trek franchise, I don't think, in that I suppose he has the kind of law-abiding sense of a Starfleet officer, but he also has the kind of we'll get to the bottom of it any way possible.
Well, it's like if you put Odo on the Enterprise-D, he would constantly be saying, Captain, what you're doing sounds absolutely insane. I'm leaving.
And then he would just storm out.
He would just leave. He would just get a shuttlecraft and go. And just go. But Chief O'Brien is one of those things that, as a supporting character, you know, I my little transporter hard drive thing, I named Transporter Room 3 because apparently everybody used nothing but Transporter Room 3 because Transporter Rooms 1 and 2 were just garbage. And that was basically where Chief O'Brien lived. And there's a series of Chief O'Brien at work, like comic strips that somebody or another did that I saw on Tumblr at some point.
Yeah, those are fantastic.
But they're so good. And I love the idea that one of the main characters on a Star Trek series is the guy effectively like the elevator attendant from another Star Trek series. That in and of itself, conceptually, I think is great. It's the kind of thing that, as they're looking to do spin-offs of Star Wars, and I'm getting us way off the rails, I really would love the perspective of, you know, the families of some of those stormtroopers who died in that horrible industrial accident at that construction site of that space station that they were working on.
And their quest for vengeance.
Exactly. But yeah, the weird, like, does this episode in particular move the overall plot of the world of Deep Space Nine forward? No, it's just like a slice of life in the middle of deep space with rough Klingon mating rituals at the center of it, and some like 7-year itch, will they, won't they, bored, working Joes kind of B story thing going on. At different parts of this episode, I almost fell out of my chair again, like having not seen this for a while, having totally forgot the war. Good God, y'all, what is it good for? Almost verbatim quote. Reference that it just like this little throwaway stuff that either that was Ron Moore or a specific member of his writing room that did those specific references that just makes Deep Space Nine a totally different thing.
It's a lot of it's a weird contrast, right? Because it's in many respects it's darker than most Star Trek. Well, than all of the existing Star Trek series. Well, maybe the exception of Enterprise, because you can feel like they're at the edge of danger and they're trying to figure out stuff. But certainly compared to the Next Generation and the original series, much, much darker.
Next Generation, and this is something that, again, I want people to send me death threats for. it was saddled with the. I have a huge amount of respect for Gene Roddenberry and everything he created and everything he did. God bless him. He brought us Star Trek, and that's great. But in his later years, especially Next Generation, in the years of it that he was involved, he had this huge stress on, no, there's no money and there's no conflict and everybody lives in a utopia. And it's these utopiateers going around the galaxy teaching everybody how to be utopiateers. And I think that's tremendously boring. And that's why the first couple seasons of Next Generation are tremendously boring. And why things like, no, let's get rid of this, feminist type, doctor lady and replace her with, my pal from years ago who, no offense to Diana Muldaur, but there were all sorts of weird Roddenberry appeasing choices made in those early years of Next Generation that as you got later into Next Generation and as Deep Space Nine came into existence, it felt more like a lived in kind of a world where Deep Space Nine, some people like to say, oh, well, they're just like out on the corner of nowhere. It's kind of like the frontier boomtown sort of thing. It is much more wagon train Western in space than Next Generation was for the majority of the time that Roddenberry had his hands on it, where somebody gets shot outside of the saloon or, is trying to smuggle things across the border to the neutral zone or something. And that kind of stuff really excites me. And it's not just because I like Westerns, but because, as much respect as I have for Roddenberry, I feel like he went back on a bunch of the promise of, oh, it's a wagon train to the stars and it's a Western in space. And he ended up taking it in a direction of everybody's happy and everything's perfect.
And it's difficult to tell an interesting story when everybody's happy and everything's perfect, because while yes, as a dream for humanity, that is a fantastic vision for a television show that's supposed to entertain me, it's really boring.
I got an idea for a drama full of conflict made up of no conflict.
Exactly. It's perfect. Also, they're wearing jumpsuits.
They're wearing jumpsuits. No underwear. There's no underwear in space. Like Star Wars.
That's true. All right. Now we're going to back to the episode at hand, because we haven't even started talking about what happens in this episode.
I think we can actually get this part out of the way pretty quickly. I think we'll be fine.
I think it's all right. I will quickly go through what happens. So basically, we've already touched on the high points. Grilka, who in previous episode Quark married for a variety of reasons that we won't get into at the moment.
Immigration status. You're talking about the Star Trek episode. Sorry,
exactly.
I'm talking about something else.
Although it was kind of a similar situation there.
Yeah, it was kind of skirting around patriarchal society rules, which as an anthropologist fascinate me. That's why the earlier episode, I was like, oh God, how did I forget that one existed? Because that was one of my favorite early season episodes.
It is a great episode. So go check that out. but not the one we're talking about. She's arrived on Deep Space Nine, and Worf catches sight of her as she's making her way to Quark's bar, and he suddenly and without much explanation falls deeply and madly in love with her.
Comically, clownishly.
It's true. And then she goes to Quark's bar, she hugs Quark, and Worf is disgusted because Worf, not a big fan of Quark. And then we cut to the subplot of this episode, which is needs a little setup, because if you don't know that, in fact, Kira Nerys is carrying Miles O'Brien's baby, but that does not mean that Miles and Kira are a couple. There was an accident in which Keiko, who was pregnant, and Kira Nerys were on a shuttlecraft, and somehow the pregnancy got transferred from one to the other. So Kira,
thanks to a science thing.
Exactly. Kira has Miles' baby. She's moved in with the O'Briens for some reason.
Through his company.
It's true. In come space. And knock on our door. They have the Regal Beagle. It's Three's Company in space, exactly. And they, Julian is eavesdropping on his onto a fight that Quark can hear, so he overhears that. And we don't really, I'm not quite sure why they even included this. I guess for a little tension, they're fighting, and then that's the end of that.
So that there's somebody to comment on. It sounds like you characters are in conflict. I don't know about this.
What's going to happen?
But and we should mention that the pregnancy of Kira was science explained in this way because in real life, Nena Visitor was pregnant with the child of her then real life dude slash, I don't know if they were married at this point, Alexander Siddig, who plays Dr. Bashir.
That's right. It's all very incestuous.
Yeah, lots of people sleeping with each other.
It's true. You can't. It just happens. What happens in Deep Space Nine stays in Deep Space Nine. So Miles then goes off to get some medicine for Kira because she's pregnant, and apparently we find out that Bajorans sneeze a lot when they're pregnant.
We got those nose things. I mean, come on.
It's true. The ridges, they collect bacteria, apparently. And so Bashir makes some inappropriate comments to Miles about watching Kira bathe, which was an interesting moment.
And O'Brien helped her out of the bath, and he says, I bet you looked. like he's in an Austin Powers movie.
I know, it was very strange. But I guess Julian is a little, he's lonely. He's single. He's vaguely annoying.
He's a lonely, genetically engineered genius.
It's true. Nobody loves the super smart genius. And he is, in fact, he's in this episode very little. And he is probably my least favorite Deep Space Nine character.
Oh, poor Julian. Here's the thing is, I loved Julian from the beginning because I felt bad for him. I was like, he kind of reminds me of me when I'm kind of dumb.
But well, that's why I like Reg Barclay so much.
Because you have anxiety issues?
I feel like Reg tries really hard, but he gets very easily flustered. And especially on the Enterprise when everybody was so good at their job, generally speaking. Well, good in Star Trek good terms, because over the course of discussing Star Trek episodes with many people, it has become clear that Starfleet officers are borderline incompetent, generally.
Yeah, they're all huge idiots, and then they have genius moments.
Exactly. Like
they had something grafted into their DNA.
But I feel like if I were in the position of being serving on the Enterprise, I would totally be Reg Barclay. Because I would just be like, I don't know what. Without, he's also a genius, so I probably wouldn't have that part. But I would certainly just be nervous all the time. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. That's more. This is turning into a therapy session for me. Let me tell you about my mother. She's a lovely woman. So back to Deep Space Nine. So Worf is infatuated with Grilka. Because she is a Klingon woman, and she is, I mean, I'm not going to argue, she is an attractive for Klingon, so hey, good for Worf. So he goes into Quark's bar to get her attention by ordering blood wine and challenging one of her guards to a fight, basically, well, saying that he stinks. And then her elder advisor says, hey, Worf, come here. So he's like, all right, he goes over, and he basically says, listen, you've been cast out of the Empire. There's no chance you're marrying Grilka, so hit the bricks. Worf is very sad, but he understands, because it is the honorable thing to do. and he leaves. But then this is where the complication comes in, because Quark is quite interested in Grilka, and Grilka seems quite interested in Quark, if not just for his financial acumen, because it seems like Grilka has got her house. She leads a house, and it's a little low on funds. So Quark offers to examine her books for her, which is could be the worst innuendo ever, and she accepts.
So it feels kind of like they were in storyline, let's move it ahead phase, and let's basically take an episode, burn it, and we'll go ahead and address all this time that O'Brien and Nerys are spending with each other in their quarters living together, and we'll get past that. We'll get over that. We will check off Quark in a Klingon battle uniform from the bucket list.
Which is fantastic.
Which is amazing. And we get this really great sequence where, using a science thing, and there are all these little science things throughout Deep Space Nine that make hilariously weird things happen, where in a big fight, Quark gets Cyrano de Bat-left by Worf, who is in the other room, and they're monitoring his vitals through the wall. And so instead of it really being Quark, it's Worf mimicking everything with a super advanced version of Google Glass and, I guess, like some sort of completely unexplained cybernetic controlled contraption.
You don't need to think about it. So, yes.
I don't know. I've got to say, though, Armin Shimerman deserved an Emmy for the way that he did the, like, puppet on a string kind of stuff when he was being unnaturally moved in ways that he wasn't expecting by Worf in the other room.
Yes. So he Quark turns to Worf to help him woo Grilka because he is a stranger to the ways of the Klingons and thinks that all of their rituals are basically ridiculous. So Worf and Dax team up to kind of help him and coach him. And then through a series of events, Quark is wooing successfully Grilka. Her bodyguard is disgusted, challenges Quark to a duel, which he knows he will die, or at least get beaten. Probably die, though, because we're talking about Klingons here. So Worf... Well, actually, I think Dax cooks up this idea of having Worf control Quark.
That's how she proves that she's a science officer.
That's right. And throughout this, Dax is just unabashedly flirting with Worf, unbelievably, saying, well, why are you interested in Grilka? And he's like, well, she's magnificent. And she's, you know, saying, well, you don't notice things that are right in front of you. Let me talk a lot of Klingon.
Like, puff chest out.
Exactly. And he is oblivious to this. And I thought it was interesting. So Worf is one of these characters that's a tradition in Star Trek in that he is a fish out of his own culture. And so he reacts by trying to be the epitome of that, right? So we had Spock, who was half human, half Vulcan, so he decided he had to be the ultimate Vulcan. And now we have Worf. He is kind of raised by humans through a variety of things. He gets discommodated, so his reaction is to be even more Klingon than any Klingon you can ever meet. And yet, he thinks it's okay to basically be a puppet master for Quark and fight his battle for him, which doesn't seem so honorable. It seems like a nice thing to do for a friend, even though Worf doesn't really like Quark. But I had a little trouble with that part. I mean, I think it's a great scene, but it just doesn't seem like it's true to Worf's character.
Yeah, a lot of it, no comment against the actors, because it's the script that they were given, and it's kind of the nature of Star Trek, and it can be kind of hokey and goofy. But this one was very original series like to me in that it was like watching a teleplay version of a stage farce where everybody has these ridiculous, larger than life, impossibly unrealistic emotional swings that result in just some of the, you know, kind of the goofiest, not out of character, but like trying too hard to send the archetypes of the character home. where, like you were saying, Worf has to be hyper Klingon and Dax is into Worf, so she's got to be hyper into Worf.
She's really into Worf.
She is so into Worf, just she is now into Worf, period, end of story. This marks the point where, period, end of story, Dax and Worf is a thing.
It is. Yes, by the end of this episode, it is definitely a thing. And then we have, continuing our subplot of Kira and O'Brien, and they're trying to adjust to this new world where Kira's carrying O'Brien's baby. O'Brien's been massaging Kira a lot because...
and lots and lots of references to how much he is massaging her. And your muscles look at his wife. His wife, Keiko, played by the wonderful Rosalind Chow, during that era, and even to this day, one of the most prominent Asian Americans on television ever, because of how she was ever present in the series. Miles, her muscles look tense from over here. Get over there. Get in there, champ. Get in there.
It's true. She's really into watching Miles massage Kira. And no judgment here. But
some people live their lives that way.
That's true. I don't live in Deep Space Nine. You know, it gets lonely, I'm sure. And as Miles points out, it's a big station. So, they're falling in love with each other, or maybe not falling in love, but they're certainly awakening feelings with one another.
They're spending a lot of proximity together, yes, while on a station out in the middle of deep space.
That's right. Rubbing unguents on one another, and things happen. Things come up. And so Miles talks about how he kind of misses Ireland, and Kira's like, well, you have some leave, go to Ireland for 3 weeks. And Miles is like, you're carrying my baby, I can't leave. Kira says, well, I wouldn't mind going to Ireland with you. It would be really nice. And Miles says, yes, it would be. And then they immediately stop touching each other.
Hold on, you've got to, I'm not going to have you imitate or drop in a clip of her intonation, but her, I could go to you with Ireland in 3 weeks. I mean, true. It's very much a,
it's not subtle.
You could go Deep Space Nine if you want.
That's right.
It is so blatant. Like, I can imagine the actors getting the script and going, oh, I'm going to have fun with this.
It is a fun episode overall. But yes, there's a lot of people falling in and out of love. So Kira and Miles both immediately realize, hey, this is not the way we should be going at all. So they're like, okay. Kira's like, I'm just going to go to Bajor for a little bit. And Miles is like, that's a fantastic idea. You should go to Bajor. But Keiko is like, what? You can't go to Bajor by yourself. Miles, you're going with her.
No. You two need to spend more time alone touching each other.
That's right.
That's what I think.
I can't go with you because I have a big botany thing. So you...
Yeah, she always has a botany thing going on. Like, she is the busiest botanist in the history of the profession.
It's true. There's a lot of botany that needs to get done on Deep Space Nine. I'm not quite sure why, but there is. And she is the woman.
When you're in space, you got to have plants. You just got to have a lot of plants.
There's no getting around it. So then they... We'll finish up this subplot. They go off to... A little runabout to go down to Bajor. They have a very revealing conversation in which basically, Miles is like, well, tell me about where we're going. And Kira describes the most romantic place you can ever think of, a 200-year-old cottage next to a lovely river with beautiful views from every room. There's no one near for miles. And Miles is like, I really can't go with you.
No, literally, there's no one near for miles, for miles other than her.
I'm the only one near Miles. See what I did there? Everybody? And so Miles is like, okay, I gotta go. I can't handle this. And Kira's like, all right, but what are you going to tell Keiko? And he's going to be like, well, you left without me, and I'll just deal with an angry Keiko. I'd rather deal with an angry Keiko about this than what could possibly happen on Bajor, because I have no control, apparently.
Because I am not going to be the main series character whose character is reset to philandering pregnant lady doer.
That's right. Even though it is his child. But so she goes off to Bajor.
He didn't put it there.
That's true. It was science.
The writer's room put it there with science.
That's true. So she goes off to Bajor. He goes off, takes a cold shower. Also, he displays an interesting outfit on the runabout. God. I wanted to draw attention to his tunic.
not since James Kirk's green girdle shirt have I been so delighted to see one of my favorite Trek actors in one of my favorite ridiculous patterned shirts.
It is a hideous shirt, and this is coming from me. That says a lot. But then back to Quark and Grilka. They're getting along. He wins the fight. He doesn't kill the bodyguard because it would be Worf killing him. So Worf basically... Quark really wants to kill him. Worf makes him not kill him. In a very funny point where Quark is like, okay, well, I guess I'm not going to kill you. And I'm going to... Okay, I guess I'm kneeling. And I guess I'm going to give this to you now. Because he doesn't know what he's doing. Because Worf is controlling his body. Thanks to science. And then they're very happy. Grilka is quite happy with Quark. And she expresses her happiness
violently.
Yeah, violently, as any Klingon should. Although Worf is still controlling Quark at this point. So it's kind of creepy because he really gets into the I guess, Klingon love embrace that happens before Dax, figuring out what's going on, turns off the little device and leaves Worf high and dry. But not for long, because she then basically says, Worf, you're an idiot. I'm right in front of you. I love you madly all of a sudden. And let's fight with the Bat'leth. And then get it on. And that's what they do.
I just suddenly decided I absolutely had to have you, Worf. Right now, no rhyme or reason, but just the notion that another of your kind could have you, I decided that I must possess you.
That's right. Suddenly, well, I mean, that does sometimes happen when you don't realize you have feelings for someone until they express interest in someone else. And then all of a sudden, you think, whoa, I've got to get a move on it. And she gets a move on it.
I think there is something to, Worf gets it on with an old man in a young woman's body.
I think that could be a number of unlicensed spin-offs.
I think there's a lot of fan fiction out there about
this. I think that you're probably right. Basically, the episode ends with them, Grilka and Quark, in sickbay. I guess the writers needed to tell us that, yes, in fact, they had sex. So
yes, Quark, indeed, they had sex, and it was very violent.
It was very violent. So Quark and Grilka are getting medical attention from Julian, and he said, what were you doing? And then he thinks better of himself and doesn't want to hear the answer. And then in come Dax and Worf, quite disheveled, and he's like, what happened to you? And they give a
woman I obsessed about for like four seasons.
Exactly. This isn't awkward at all. And then before they could answer, he's like, on second thought, I'm really just going to stop asking this question.
On second thought, I'm just the expositional narrator here.
That's right. I will wave a scanner.
Correct me if I'm wrong, like, we never see Grilka again.
Grilka, this is the last appearance of Grilka.
Her second and last, and so it resolves, and then I guess Grilka just disappeared.
Hey, well, she's not going to marry a Ferengi.
She lost all of her money. She was ruined and lives on the streets now.
Probably. Well, no, what Grilka, I assume what happened is, because they bring up Quark looking at her books and then never mention it again, I assume Quark magically fixed all her financial woes and she went back to the Klingon homeworld to marry some other Klingon befitting her station. She's already married Quark, so she's not going to go down that route again.
Yeah.
And then it ends with Dax and Worf having a conversation about how they're going to handle this relationship.
So what are we now? So like...
Exactly.
And this is Worf. This voice. So, like... Because we got to, like, do things right, you know? And Dax's response is essentially, don't try to put labels on us. Let's just do this thing called love.
I'm a free spirit, man. You can't capture the wind. And then it ends with the worst fake laughter I have ever heard coming from Michael Dorn.
We find this funny.
And then end scene, credits, the episode is over.
I love that in the course of discussing this episode, we both talked about how we think Deep Space Nine is our favorite Trek series, and we've been ripping holes in how like slipshod and unnatural and forced this entire episode is.
Well, that's, I think the whole point of this podcast is this is all coming from a place of love, because I really do enjoy Star Trek, and I thought this episode, I mean, it entertained me, But there are a lot of ridiculous things that happen in Star Trek, and this episode
this
is
episode
a pretty
does
good example of many of them. So overall, what do you think of this episode? If you had to rank it,
is there a numerical scale?
There is not. This is just it's not.
I would rank it 3.5 kapla.
Out of how many kaplas? That's the question.
I don't know, because Kalos is infinite and everywhere and watches us.
Good answer. The judges will accept it.
Yes. The ruling council.
That's right.
The Klingon High Council declares it.
This is one of my favorite subgenres of Deep Space Nine are the Quark-centric episodes, because I find Quark to be a very amusing little character. And this is a collision with one of my lesser favorite subgenres of Star Trek series, which are Klingon episodes, because I generally find them to be kind of plodding and full of nonsensical rituals. But you add the two together, and it makes it much more entertaining. A little dab of Quark never hurts anybody.
You're lucky I do not have a ducta on me, because I would stab you where you stand. I can't remember the Klingon name for coward. So I've dishonored my family and my name. I've been ousted from the Empire. I'm kind of two minds about Klingon episodes. I kind of liked some of the Klingon centric episodes in Deep Space Nine worked better for me than any of the Klingon episodes before them. And then there were some from Next Generation that are just unparalleled. How great I think they are. I can be hot and cold on them, where they can feel a bit forced. It can feel like another series suddenly invading that series for an episode, but I don't entirely mind it, because it breaks up, will they, won't they, Riker and Troy, or will they, won't they, so on and so forth, or will Odo finally find the pickpocket, from episode 7 or whatever. The thing that, in the final analysis, I guess, I feel about this one is that there's another subgenre of Trek episodes that I identify as Trek Mad Libs, where if you look at the overarching plot of this, you could reverse engineer Mad Libs from it. Quark falls on the wrong side of blank and has to blank to the blank to blank. Subplot B, blank and blank discover they may have a budding romance, if only for blank calling them out about it in a gruff voice in a single scene over the course of 6 lines. And among the ones that I feel like I could reverse engineer into Mad Libs, this is one of the ones that I still enjoy as ridiculous and totally out of character how quickly a lot of things happen, resolve, and catalyze into things that affect the series until its end, really.
It's true. And a shout-out, I skipped over an important appearance by Morn, who gets thrown out of his chair by Worf early in the episode.
One of Morn's most action-packed scenes.
It's true. I was on the edge of my seat, and he was on the edge of his stool. But yes, I enjoy Morn, so hooray. Another character who would not be. Well, I guess Mott, perhaps, on the Enterprise, the barber, could be the Morn analog. Well, Moises, we've gotten to the end of the episode.
I'm so glad it wasn't Voyager. I would be, and it's not just that it's because I dislike Voyager. It's I would be so lost. But I even if it had been Voyager, I would have soldiered on.
It's what we do for our love of Star Trek. But the universe smiled upon you and did not pick a Voyager episode. So be glad. But perhaps on your return, if you decide that you would like to return, and if this episode does not destroy Random Trek, you may have to watch Captain Janeway do something.
Captain Janeway, I don't mind. It's the episodes where she basically disappears that I mind.
Oh, well, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. So thank you for joining me, and I still don't have a sign-off. So,
well, thanks for having me, and everybody can go find all my podcasts at esn.fm.
Next on Random Trek, we return to the original series for Errand of Mercy.